what's happened is that these people, the Japanese, have targeted certain industries one by one to take over from us. Oh. And they are doing it and in the name of national interest and power. And, of course, eventually we're going to wind up with the Japanese telling us and setting for us the policy that we're going to be exercising in the world and domestically. And if we sit by like the Reagan administration did over the last 8 years and let this situation continue, we're all going to be frying hamburgers for a McDonald's owned by a Japanese Zaibatsu, and we're going to be serving those hamburgers to Japanese tourists, and that's all we're going to be doing.
What's behind this great penetration of the American economy by the Japanese? And what can we do about it? We talk with an expert on international economics right now on Alternative Views. On this Alternative Views, we're going to take a close look at the Japanese penetration of the United States economy with Dr. Jack Hopper, who is an economic consultant whose Ph.D. is in international economics. He will give his own opinions and also review a book on the subject. But before we talk to Jack, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press. The first group is from March 1989.
Frank, to my surprise, yesterday morning, for the first time, I read in the New York Times an article about Daniel Sheehan in the Christic Institute. We recall that several years ago, during the Iran-Contra scandals, the Christic Institute put forth a public interest lawsuit claiming that a secret team of individuals inside and outside of the government had been involved in all kinds of political assassinations, all kinds of illegal drug dealings, all kinds of right-wing political adventures, including an illegal operation to bring arms to the Contras that smuggled drugs into the United States. Well, the Sheehan Institute was the Christic Institute, led by Daniel Sheehan, was trying to uncover the facts of Reagan administration and their friends' involvement in this illegal Contra arms drugs operation, and in putting a stop to this kind of covert actions, and filed a lawsuit on the RICO criminal investigation grounds to try to dig up the facts about the involvement of Reagan administration officials and these others in the secret team in these activities. Well, not only did the federal judge, Judge Lawrence King of the South Texas, the South Southern District of the Florida, throw the lawsuit out of court, but he sued the Christic Institute $1 million, claiming that the lawsuit was a frivolous and fanciful suit. So the Christic Institute now is subject to going out of business because of the lawsuit that's being thrown against them. So finally, the Times brings this up years after the Christic Institute had been trying to get publicity for its lawsuit. Finally, in the law section of the Times, they sympathetically discuss the plight of the Christic Institute and quote other public interest groups of what a chilling effect this fine would have if a public interest group is not allowed to go after the federal government. Then this takes another weapon of social change and reform away from progressive groups.
Particularly, it's interesting that this lawsuit and what it was all about was definitely excluded from the public and the media agenda during the election. They didn't want to talk about those things at all because they'd be injurious to Bush
right.
and Reagan.
There's another story about how McDonald's hamburgers sued a transnational information center of London for publishing a booklet, Working for Big Mac, that exposed the horrendous working conditions for McDonald's employees all over the world. And McDonald's sued this public interest London firm and put them out of business.
Oh,
so this
God.
Is a way that corporations are able to keep different public interest groups from criticizing them even.
Did they win their suit, or did they just put that little company out of business because they couldn't afford to defend themselves?
Precisely that. They simply weren't able to raise the money that would enable them to go to court to defend themselves. And so they just were forced to shut down.
This is a certain way which businesses have been doing for years, predatory lawsuits. And the big guys will bring these lawsuits. They'll know they're going to lose, but they will bankrupt the little guy that they're after. And so they achieve their end anyway. The quarterly newsletter, Global Perspectives, of the Center for Global Education, Augsburg College, has some interesting observations by Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. It's one concerning which he thinks that liberal and progressive Christians should look at, and that is comparing individual acts of barbarism, such as the bombing of the Flight 103 over Scotland, compared with structural evil, as he calls it, meaning things like U.S. state-sponsored terrorism in Central America. The media make a big fuss over the bombing of that one airplane, but they pretty much ignore the rest. And even it goes further than that. He says it's estimated that 40 million people die each year from hunger or hunger-related diseases. Now, that's the equivalent of 300 jumbo jets crashing every day with no survivors. These 40 million people die because global and national economies are set up to benefit the rich at the expense of the poor. UNICEF recently indicated the world's poorest countries last year, in 1988, sent more than $20 billion to the rich countries in the form of debt payments. To service their debt, these countries had to reduce the budgets of their health agencies by 50% and their education budgets by 25%. So UNICEF blames the deaths of more than 500,000 children in the past 12 months directly to the interest paid on the service of these debt payments. That's the impact it has on the lives of the poor. So it's about time people started looking at large structural terrorism in addition to the smaller acts of tragedy.
Now for a special media report on the public broadcasting system, gathered from information from January 1989.
There's quite a good story in the magazine Extra concerning the right-wing bias of PBS. The story begins by pointing out that in November, literally hundreds of disgruntled PBS viewers inundated the network and its affiliates with phone calls and letters complaining about the blatant conservative pro-corporate right-wing tilt to PBS talk shows. No less than three right-wing talk shows are run on the different PBS stations that star editors and contributors to William Buckley's ultra-right-wing National Review magazine. Firing Line, of course, is run by Buckley himself and has been on PBS for 20 years. And two other PBS talk shows, the McLaughlin Group and Only in One, are also talk shows that have an extreme right-wing bias. Moreover, there's a ton of other shows on PBS that are mostly business shows that have a strongly pro-corporate and anti-union tilt. They include Wall Street Week, Adam Smith's Money World, and the Nightly Business Report. So the main shows on PBS, the main talk shows, the main news, public affairs shows, are very much pro-corporate and conservative in their aslant. And it's the same thing when you look at different cable news shows. You have Morton Downey as another right-wing syndicated host. Gordon Liddy has a new tough-talking, tough right-wing talk show that he's syndicating to cable shows.
The USA Network has a new talk show with an op-ed commentary that's supposed to have both sides, but their two commentators are both from the New Republic, that's sort of a centrist right-wing journal, featuring on this show, USA Tonight, Fred Barnes and Morton Kondrake, both of whom are pro-contra foreign policy hawks. One of their first shows had a debate on November the 21st about the appointment of James Baker as Secretary of State. Kondrake on the left was just cheering Baker, Reagan, and Star Wars. Barnes on the right, meanwhile, had some conservative concerns about Baker compromising too much. But this is sort of the left-right rap you get. It's even worse on CNN, where they have their crossfire, where you have a really strong, vigorous right-winger on the right, Patrick Buchanan, and you have a barely comatose or a barely articulate moderate Tom Brady, who's supposed to be on the left and is barely a centrist. Moreover, you've got some new talk shows coming out on CNN, one called The Capital Gang, hosted by none other than Pat Buchanan, which is also going to feature Robert Novak and a panel of four conservative white men, of which the moderate is Mark Shields, who's, again, barely a centrist. So that really on all of the major talk shows, on the networks, on the cable, on PBS, you have a strong, strong conservative bias. It's only on public access shows like Alternative Views that you actually get progressive points of view.
You know, Doug, it's really so ironic and probably actually illegal about what goes on PBS, because the fairness doctrine for PBS is much more rigid than that for the commercial stations. Even after the Reagan Federal Communications Commission emasculated the fairness doctrine, but they are supposed to have balance within each program on PBS, not just within the total broadcast period, broadcast day, but within each program. So it's so ironic that here they had one day, I noticed the lineup here at the local PBS station, they had the Daily Business Report, Wall Street Week, the McLaughlin Group, which is very right wing, the Firing Line with William Buckley. I said, well, they must have one for labor, don't they?
No way.
No way. As a matter of fact, when a couple of progressive labor organizations tried to get PBS to let them sponsor or underwrite a program on PBS, merely to let the labor people just say what they wanted to. They weren't even going to have any editorial control. They were just going to provide money so that there could be programs about working people and their lives.
PBS said, no, that wouldn't be objective. That would be against the fairness doctrine.
In fact, there's a good story about this also in Extra, the corporatization of public TV by Pat Alfter, Heidi, who talks about the contradiction that 45% of the individual donors who contribute money to PBS, who give money so that PBS programming can continue, are working class people. They're either blue collar, white collar, moderate or low income working people, whereas there's no labor programs that represent the point of view of the people that actually contribute to the program. The reason for this, after Hyde speculates, is that most of the funding for PBS comes from the government, from big corporate sponsors, or from right-wing foundations, who, of course, have conservative interests and like to fund programs that represent their conservative points of view. So you'll have General Electric sponsoring programs that celebrate the wonders of new technology. You'll have a nuclear energy corporation sponsoring a program that's pro-nuclear, whereas you simply don't have the different people's groups and organizations represented. Peace movement, women's movement, environmental movement, none of these groups are able to have programs that represent their point of view, except for the odd documentary now and then that slips in. Part of the problem, Alfter Hyde says, is that because the federal government is so stingy with federal support of public television, it requires this big corporate support. She points out that the United States only spends around 77 cents per person on public broadcasting, where in Japan, $14 is spent per person on public broadcasting, in Canada, $24, and in Britain, $24.50. So we have about the stingiest public investment in public television than any Western democracy.
An example of the distortion and censorship of the material you'll see on PBS is the British documentary Blax Britannica, a part of which is shown here.
Yes, it's a film called Blax Britannica that's an award-winning documentary that was censored and butchered by the PBS station in Boston that originally showed it. And the filmmaker heard about alternative views and wrote us a letter and asked if we wanted the uncensored copy and sent it to us, and we showed it to you.
It's clear that the state at top national level and certainly at local level, the state has moved to manipulate blacks in any way that it's wanted to. There was actually a Pan-African Congress which was held there because there was a strong black community there. Now that community in this more recent period of heavy racism in the society has just been mown down, destroyed, completely destroyed.
The excuse was that Manchester was developing a ghetto. Ghettos, as had been seen from the American experience, were bad things because out of ghettos came riots and so on, and they were determined not to let it happen here.
And they felt that their policy was successful. They advertised it widely throughout Europe as an answer to the problem of black people. There are two entrances only. And this means that in a situation of social control, it is perfectly feasible and easy to control these buildings because there are only two points of access. And a relatively small force of army or police can control all the people within these buildings.
The predicament of blacks highlights the inability of British capitalism to deliver the goods. In some of Britain's major cities, places like Manchester and Birmingham and London, official government statistics show that up to 80% of black youths between the ages of 16 and 19 are unable to find work and have no visible prospect of finding full-time employment.
When you go for a job and you go for an interview, you talk pretty on the phone to the guy. Then when you come through the door and he sort of sees your face, seeing that you're black, he's trying to hide his shop, but underneath, such and such, and then you're gone. You got no chance.
The issue of immigration and immigrants came to be used quite deliberately by the state. We are still the target of a very mischievous and hypocritical debate about our presence here, our right to be here.
And I think it means that people are really rather afraid that this country might be rather swamped by people with a different culture.
We will fight you back, and we'll fight you with every bone, every nerve, every feeling, every ounce of blood we've got. We will have our country back!
So it's not surprising, out of this dual oppression of class and race, that blacks are among the leading elements mobilizing in the working class against the government, against the state itself. Every black youth on the street will tell you that the major threat for them, for all their lives in this country, has been represented by the police.
That's it. Now stop looking at the gun, look at the target. That's the one who wants to kill you. Are you ready on the firing line? The line is ready. Stand by.
Now, down, charge!
And because the blacks have refused to accept indignity and victimage, Britain is stuck with a rebellious black presence in its centers. And there is no way that Britain can get out of this situation.
Revolution, hands work. Revolution, hands work.
have more news stories later on Alternative Views. But now for the centerpiece of our program, Pearl Harbor 2. The consequences of Pearl Harbor 2 can be of much greater significance than Pearl Harbor 1.
We have a fascinating book review by a fascinating man. Jack Hopper is an economic consultant, has been on Alternative Views for a long time. You've been reading a book called Trading Places about our friends who inadvertently won World War II after all.
Trading Places by Clyde Prestowitz. Check this out of the public library.
Right. Well, now you have a PhD in economics and all, and you've been doing economic consulting. This must be right up your alley.
Well, my PhD is in international economics, as a matter of fact. Oh. So the whole issue of international trade and international economics is a matter of great interest to me. But even more so is the view of what's happening in the economy. You can hardly buy some things that aren't Japanese made. And so that brings the interesting question forward of what's taking place here. This particular writer and this book poses the issue pretty squarely that we have simply allowed the Japanese to move in and take over the lead that we had in trade and manufacturing, particularly manufacturing, and that if we don't do something about it, we are going to be in bad trouble.
Well, aren't we in bad trouble right now?
Yeah, but we're going to be in a lot worse trouble if we don't do something about this. Even though our deficit in trade with Japan is $60 billion a year, what's happened is that these people, the Japanese, have targeted certain industries one by one to take over from us. Oh. And they are doing it in the name of national interest and power. And, of course, eventually we're going to wind up with the Japanese telling us and setting for us the policy that we're going to be exercising in the world and domestically.
Can you give us an idea of how this has happened step by step?
Well, first you got to realize that there were things called zaibatsu before World War II. The Japanese had these combines, and these combines ran things. They ran the government. They didn't run the military, and that was a little bit of a conflict that they had. MacArthur thought he eliminated these zaibatsu.
And that was a combination of banks and trading companies and industrial outfits
all together. Right. They were huge combines that were self-sufficient almost. Mm-hmm. Well, these zaibatsu have come back, and the zaibatsu are what's competing with us. And, of course, there's not any free trade when the Japanese government supports the zaibatsu around the world. And so they have simply moved into the United States, taken over steel, well along taking over automobiles, machine tools, all sorts of electronic equipment. And the next target is computers and IBM. And if we don't do something about the way they're operating, they're going to drive IBM out of business.
Well, let me get some historical perspective here. You mentioned that the zaibatsu, one of the big things that the United States was going to do after World War II was to break the power of these big zaibatsu and to make the Japanese industry and commercial system competitive. They had antitrust laws, and they permitted unions for the first time and a multiplicity of political parties. MacArthur was there to run it. However, I saw a fascinating article in Far Eastern Review several years ago where it turns out that the large American banks, investment banks, Wall Street firms, worked over a period of time to undermine these reforms which MacArthur was instituting and carrying out. And over a period of time, through government action and through economic international action, they were able to do away with these reforms and get their people back into power in Japan and get the old establishment back in power. And the reason they did this was because these U.S. Wall Street firms had relationships and joint ventures with the Japanese before World War II. And so they were wanting to reestablish these relationships and get the gravy train coming back. They didn't want any of this competition, this antitrust and unions coming in. So this is some interesting background, how the international banking community got these guys reestablished.
Well, Prestwich...
Does he talk about that?
Well, he doesn't. In fact, he has a different theory that makes more sense than that one. Now, that one may have had There may have been some part to play. Mm-hmm. But he makes the argument that the occupation people didn't speak Japanese, didn't understand the culture, didn't know anything about the Japanese, and simply allowed the same Japanese civil service and bureaucracy to continue running things during the occupation and later as they did before. And of course, they were Zaibatsu trained. And MacArthur and his people didn't even know what they were doing. And so immediately after the occupation was over, and during the Korean War, when we force-fed Japanese industry to rebuild based on the need to sell and to build and to support that war like that, we were out of there. And immediately, of course, the system began to restore itself. Now, there may have been some part to play that took place on the international scale with international banks and whatnot, but this man doesn't give that very much credence.
They're probably both going on.
Probably was, but he places the most important role of this process to simply the fact that the same people continued to do it, and they had every intention, as soon as MacArthur was out of the way, to restore the system, and they put it in place, and as soon as he was gone, they restored it.
Jack, one of the things you mentioned was that today Japan is achieving leadership in the computer and communications industry, and that this has grave implications for our national security as well as our own industrial development. Do you want to go into this in some detail?
Well, it's sort of interesting. If we're going to have to build rockets and then have the Japanese put the guidance systems in 5 or 10 years, that's where we're headed, of course, because the computer chip business, the semiconductor business that we invented and that we developed, we have lost. In fact, Trading Places really deals with the semiconductor industry, which has lost out to the Japanese. We have traded places with the Japanese in terms of our ascendancy. It's sort of interesting, of course, you go on from that particular industry. Right now in the news is the discussion of the fact that the Japanese are making the first inroads into our aircraft industry. They refuse to buy F-16 aircraft, and so we are about to cave in with them and do a cooperative deal with them and give them our technology. General Dynamics is going to give them the technology, and they're in effect going to invent their own air weaponry and commercial air system, and they're going to take over from Boeing and McDonnell Douglas. That's the next step, and that issue is partially unresolved because we haven't decided whether we're going to give them all the technology or just some of the technology right now.
Jack, the precedent for this was set in the electronics industry, where the U.S. invented television, even VCRs. It's little known that it was an American firm in 1970 that created the first VCR for the home market, but it was never marketed or developed here. It was sold to the Japanese, and since then, all televisions, all VCRs, most electronics are made in Japan. They have the key patents. They're the ones that actually produce this. So the same thing could easily happen in the computer microchip semiconductor industry, where the U.S., again, played the leading role in developing these technologies, but then they slowed down, and the Japanese have appear to be, at least, taking over, just like they did electronics.
Well, the Japanese government and the Japanese Zaibatsu are of one mind, one purpose, and of course they divide and conquer with each country and with each industry. In this country, of course, we have no coherent policy. Each one of these industries can be picked off. Each one of these companies is being picked off, and one by one, the Japanese power, concentrated power, is picking them all off. And meanwhile, we have these fools, these nitwits who run our foreign policy and our trade policy, who say, hey, free trade, free trade. Meanwhile, the Japanese are just taking advantage of free trade by wiping out what few traders are left. And we don't seem to be able to understand that eventually this free trade thing is going to drive us to the point where our security is going to be at risk. We are spending so much time worrying about the communist menace, we had better worry about the Japanese menace.
Well, Jack, I haven't read the book, so I don't know does he get involved in how intertwined a lot of U.S. businesses and finance capital are with the Japanese. For instance, I remember a few years ago when U.S. Steel was saying, oh, we just can't compete, we're going to have to shut down plants because the Japanese are doing so much better, et cetera, and we can't compete with a foreign low-wage system. Yet, on the other hand, I read in some other articles where U.S. Steel was investing in steel plants overseas and also in Japan, plus the fact that the U.S. banks which also had most of the stock of U.S. Steel and had directors on the board of U.S. Steel, were also investing in Japanese steel. At the same time, they were running down the U.S. Steel industry.
Well, this man has a different view of it. Now, this man right here has a lot of experience, and he makes a very persuasive case. And his case is the Japs don't do business with anybody but Japanese. Japanese do not go into partnership with anybody else. And to the extent that they allow a certain amount of investment or a certain amount of marketing, it's just a sop. They got no intentions of truly doing that on any kind of a systematic basis, because they don't do business with foreigners except to get their money. They don't believe in having associations with people outside of the Japanese. The Japanese culture calls for that.
Although if they need foreign capital investment, it makes perfect sense to open their markets to this kind of investment from U.S. multinationals as long as they can control it.
But they haven't done that. I mean, that's the whole problem. They refuse to do that. They haven't had to.
Yeah.
They haven't had to because the way the government operates, it allows these people to have extremely high leverage businesses, extremely low risk, and extremely low cost of interest loans. Mm. And what has happened is that the Japanese system, meaning the combination of the government and the zaibatsus, has eliminated risk for most of these businesses. As a matter of fact, most Japanese businesses make lower rates of return, do not do as well as American companies, because they don't emphasize profit, they emphasize growth. And what they're looking for is market share and growth, and once they get their market share and growth, they drive their competitors out of business, and then they make what they want to, because they set the price then the way they want to.
Well, now, the U.S. Manufacturers have bought into this system for their own profit, because you take the shell, take the body off of a U.S. car, and you'll find Japanese-made components all the way through.
And here's the Colt. The Colt is a Japanese car that Chrysler is importing. That's right. That takes place. But once again,
that's a whole car. That's a whole car. But I mean, every car. Most every car you buy, the components inside, various components, are going to be Japanese.
Well, certainly the electronic components are certainly going to be.
Plus the fact that...
And the tires probably will be, too.
Is it General Motors or no, I think it's Chrysler that has, I think, 50% ownership in a joint venture with Isuzu. So the American multinationals are involved in this as well.
Yes.
They don't see this as a danger at all?
Well, no. And the interesting part is, those combination companies sell into this market, but they don't sell in the Japanese market.
I see.
There
they
is no marketing.
They keep a closed home market.
Absolutely.
They do joint ventures as a means of penetration.
Absolutely.
Of foreign markets.
And they're moving into the common market right now. And the common market had enough sense to realize that what they did in the United States was something they could do in Europe,
right.
and they're trying to put some barriers on them. And they're making a lot more sense with their trade policy than we did. This man makes the case that if we don't do something about it, if we don't make some moves, and if we sit by like the Reagan administration did over the last 8 years and let this situation continue, we're all going to be frying hamburgers for a McDonald's owned by a Japanese zaibatsu, and we're going to be serving those hamburgers to Japanese tourists, and that's all we're going to be doing.
Jack, what sort of...
That's no exaggeration, because...
That's the argument he makes.
The term now is de-industrialized, post-industrialized society, and the Republicans are saying, isn't this wonderful, we're in a service economy.
Yeah, but the service economy is going to belong to the Japanese, and they're going to be the only ones with money to buy the service. I mean, it goes further than the fact that we're going to deindustrialize and we're going to be a service economy. We're not even going to own our service economy. Well, they're going to own it, and we're going to be providing them with the services. They're the only ones that are going to have money if this thing continues the way this man makes the argument that is continuing.
Well, what would be the government and industry response that would prevent this Japanese takeover?
Well, his argument is twofold. One is, we've got to begin to centralize and make sense out of our trading policy. Over and over and over, industries have brought suit under unfair trade practices and dumping, the whole issue of dumping. And the Japanese have bought off enough American lobbyists and have penetrated certain trade associations to neutralize those. I mean, it may be too late. But if the administration doesn't get a unified act together of understanding what is best for this country, and free trade is certainly not best, it's obvious, then it's going to continue. The alternative, of course, the other piece of this was our foreign trade deficit is creating some of these problems too. And of course, the regular domestic deficit is allowing the Japanese to buy up the country as it goes along. And the more the Japanese buy in, the more control they're going to exercise politically. And they are exercising political control now that goes beyond the Israelis. Mm-hmm. It goes beyond the Arabs, because they've got so much money to spend and they're so rational with it, and they've bought so many revolving door administration people that it's a real question is whether we can reverse it now or not.
Jack, I think there is a clever Republican rationale for that, for this whole policy, and that is that one of the reasons they give to have this free trade policy, so-called, is that it means lower consumer prices, so that if the public can buy more goods at lower prices, they're happier, because that's what they've been taught is the route to happiness through the consumer society. So this makes people happy with Republican policies.
Well,
they're just not aware of what the long-term implications are or what's behind
true.
This.
That has been true, and that is a short-term aspect. But obviously, we've had national security interests that have come forward. The Pentagon has been concerned about this for some time. The truth really is that this man makes a very persuasive argument that we're going to wind up as a colony of Japan. And I remember there was a colony that they took over from China called Manchuria. They renamed it Manchukuo. And I wonder what they would rename the United States once they took it over.
Who knows? Well, there's something of historical nature that I'd like to ask you, and that is, in the United States, when we have these big monopoly and oligopolistic industries where they drive out competitors, except for a couple of buddies who are working with them, as a result, we got high prices and inferior products. Well, the Japanese have set up monopolies at home, but they seem to have superior products. Now, what's the difference? How come they have quality from their monopoly and we have inferior quality?
Well, you named two things. You named quality and you named price. The Japanese consumer pays 50% more for Japanese products than the American consumer.
For the same product?
Absolutely.
You mean a VCR?
Absolutely.
There will
yes.
cost more than here?
Oh, far more. They're dumping them in this country.
Oh, that's right.
They're dumping them.
I saw
Furthermore,
yeah,
the Japanese
right.
consumer
right.
is a sheep. I mean, over there, the zaibatsu, meaning the business interests, run everything, including politics. The Japanese diet is in effect under the tight control of these government agencies,
the diet,
the ministries,
their parliament.
Their parliament is under the control of the government ministries and the zaibatsu, and therefore all policy is designed to further the national interest, which is power, and that's what it was in the pre-war deal. The truth really is that the Japanese have not changed any over the last 100 years. The Japanese culture continues to look down on all foreigners. The Japanese culture continues to see themselves as supermen. The Japanese culture continues to place everybody in an inferior position. They do not teach all the horror stories of World War II. The Japanese are still hated throughout Asia, because they treated the other Asians so bad during World War II that they're still in repulsion all over the system over there. And of course, I think we forget about the rape of Nanking. We forget about the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. We forget that the Doolittle Raiders who were captured in the raid on Tokyo were captured and beheaded. And we forget how many prisoners were allowed to starve to death. We forget the barbaric nature of the Japanese, only not because they're necessarily barbarians, but because they think all foreigners are inferior and therefore they can treat them like dirt. They could have taught Hitler about the master race.
Well, the size and strength of the Japanese economy in relationship to the United States, what is that now?
Well, the population is 120 compared to our 240. It's only about half. And I don't have numbers on the gross national product, but it's certainly creeping up there.
Well, I know they have the largest banks now by far, and their equivalent of their stock exchange is considerably larger than
ours. Yeah, it's obvious that they wouldn't be anywhere near like that if they didn't have all of our markets.
Because it's a very small country, really.
Not only that, but they've got a relatively weak, still got a relatively low standard of living. Sure, the cost of living over there can be extremely horrifying if you have to go over there and serve. But if you look at the kind of advantages the Japanese people on the whole have, they're still not very good. Their homes are small. They have to commute 3 and 4 hours to work. Things are extremely expensive over there, even for the people that have cradle-to-the-grave jobs with the zaibatsu.
And they work, my gosh, they work 12, 16 hours a day, particularly the middle executives and all like that. They just drive. There was an article that somebody wrote that called On the Assembly Line at Toyota, We Are Driven, and it showed how hard they worked their workers, but they seem to...
It's interesting that the Japanese plants that have been built in this country are being built on a colonial scale. By that, the local businesses are controlled tightly out of Japan, and they're authoritarian. They're not union, of course, and the workers are treated just like Japanese workers. And it's not going to work very good if that's what we expect in the way of manufacturing, is for the Japanese to come over here and give us jobs, because we're not going to like the way the Japs are going to treat us. The Japanese don't look at American workers as they look on Japanese workers. They have a different attitude.
Well, now, what can be done? Now, some people say, well, we got to put up trade barriers and maybe quotas so that the Japanese...
Well, quotas are... But they're dead wrong. We put quotas on automobiles, and all it did was make the Japanese rich, because they got... The price increase, well, if you're going to do things like that, you got to put tariffs on.
Yeah.
There, if you put a tariff on, the difference between the cost imported and the cost of sale, the government takes. Our government takes it. The Japanese manufacturer doesn't take that. But that's not the answer. I mean, that may be part of the answer.
Even tariffs aren't, because they increase the tariffs. But what happens? It just means the U.S. car manufacturers, for instance, immediately raise the price of their cars, and we still get the same old lousy quality of American cars at a higher price.
Right.
So what is the solution?
Well, part of the solution has got to be to recognize the problem and to eliminate this nonsense about free trade being nirvana. And that's what the Reagan administration did. They just wouldn't talk about anything that smacked of limiting the Japanese ability to invade this country. They wouldn't consider it. And then we got begin to wonder what the effects are going to be, what's it going to lead to, what has it led to, where is it going to lead, and what's it going to take to stop it. One thing it's going to take to stop it are some policies that either require them to open up their markets and to do for our businesses what we allow them to do over here, or shut them down. I mean, it may cost us money. The consumer may not be able to get all the stuff he wants for all the price, but sooner or later, he's going to wind up with almost no choices domestically if this continues.
There is another thing I'd like to ask you about, and that I've read where the Japanese are actually buying up enormous areas of the third world, like in Mexico. They've actually, the Japanese is a small country, but they're buying up huge tracts of land for agriculture in other countries.
Well, the Japanese have such a trade surplus everywhere with everybody that it's not any wonder that they have surplus money in every country. I mean, the truth is, not only are our manufacturers finding it impossible to sell to the Japanese market, everybody else is finding the same problem. The Japanese simply exclude all foreigners. They're not discriminating against us. They just don't like any foreigner, don't like any old men. And so they run trade surpluses. Therefore, they can buy all sorts of real estate and everything else in every country in the world. I mean, what they couldn't do with a military approach, they can do with an economic approach.
Yeah. They've got their Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere all over the country.
They've moved it.
It's the
Greater World Prosperity Sphere. They don't limit it these days just to East Asia anymore. Yeah.
We have time now for some more news stories from the alternative press. Those small publications which are not under the financial or ideological constraints of the establishment media.
Those of you who watch network television know that they always claim to be fair and objective and give, quote, both sides an equal chance. Well, ha. Fairness and accuracy in media, the watchdog group, and they made a study of Nightline. And the study analyzed the transcripts of 865 episodes from 1985 to 1988. Here's what they found out. 80% of the guests, the U.S. guests, came from the government, corporations, or professions. Only 5% came from public interest groups, and less than 2% were labor or racial or ethnic group leaders. 89% of the guests were men, 92% of the guests were white, and heading the list of the people who were on the most were those unindicted war criminals, Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. They were on 14 times. They were followed by such notables as the admitted perjurer Elliot Abrams and Jerry Falwell. Well, you can make up your own epithets for Jerry Falwell. And the study's authors said, concluding, well, overwhelmingly it's white male representatives of powerful institutions who interpret the world for us on the Nightline. Of course, if there is one, somebody from this 2% who gets in, it wasn't any of the cover biggies, well, they're all attacked by the 92 or 98%. And, of course, Ted Koppel, he criticizes those people, too. The Accuracy and Media Group also say the significant thing is that although they may have foreign leaders on their program to defend themselves and to criticize U.S. foreign policy, they exclude domestic critics from U.S. Discussing foreign policy. However, last night I saw something for the first time. They had somebody from CISPES on.
Oh, really?
The Citizens in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. For the first time I know of, they had somebody on, and this guy made the government boy look like a fool.
Frank, it's also worth mentioning that Ted Koppel is one of the most effective hatchet people taking on leftists and liberals, that he's blatantly partisan. Whenever there's someone from the left or someone from Iran, Koppel gets really tough and really mean and really tries to cut him down, whereas some of the most outrageous conservatives can say some of the most outrageous things, and Koppel just goes smilingly along. So there's another imbalance on Nightline. There's a story in these times about how some of the major corporations control the point of view of programming on the public broadcasting system. We've reported already on Alternative Views how almost all of the talk shows are slanted to the right, that three of the major talk shows have editors from William Buckley's National Review who control them. Buckley's Firing Line, the McLaughlin Report, and another right-wing talk show. Well, likewise, on their science programming and other more seemingly innocuous documentary type of programming, it's mostly major corporations that underwrite these programs, guaranteeing that, for instance, science programs won't be critical of big corporations. DuPont, for instance, subsidizes the popular, science fiction show, the science program, Newton's Apple, which reports on popular science issues. And DuPont, of course, is one of the major pollutants. Some of the chemicals that they produce are highly toxic. And by funding this kind of program, they're able to buy a environment on public television that won't be critical of corporate interests.
Well, you suppose this story smacks of racism a little bit? When the Washington Redskins won the Super Bowl, Doug Williams, the winning quarterback, got $125,000 in commercial endorsements. Well, that's pretty good. But when white boy Jim McMahon led the Chicago Bears to victory in 1986, he didn't get $125,000. He got $1 million in endorsements. And Phil Sims, another white quarterback, got $750,000. The Wall Street Journal also had a story about this and indicated that eight out of the 10 most popular athletes in the country in 1987 were black. But of the 12 highest paid athletes, only one was black, Michael Jordan.
There is a report on the latest adventures of Don Gregg, a close associate with George Bush, who ran the illegal Contra Arms drug network during the Reagan years. And it appears that he's about to be nominated for ambassador to South Korea. in these Times reports that when Ronald Reagan appointed James R. Lilly as ambassador to South Korea in 1986, the Koreans worried that Lilly, who was the former CIA station chief in China, might come to the job with two different hats on, i.e. CIA and diplomatic. Now South Koreans are worried similarly with Don Gregg, that they're going to have a CIA insider there as their ambassador, and they're not very happy about this. In fact, Gregg spent most of his adult life with the CIA in Asia, serving in China, in Burma, in Vietnam, and in South Korea, where he was the CIA station chief between 1973 and 1976. Since then, as I've indicated, he's been one of George Bush's closest associates, so he's being paid off for all of his years of service with the ambassadorship to South Korea. Well, an editorial in the Seoul newspaper, Chunsung Ilbo, observed, in expressing their general impression of the designation of Donald Gregg as ambassador to Korea, most Koreans want to ask, why a former CIA man again? People familiar with Korea should know that Koreans are sensitive to the appearance and structure of things. It is not our intention, they say, to question Gregg's personality or abilities. We only worry that consecutively appointing CIA men as ambassadors may give Koreans cause to think that their country is regarded not as the object of diplomacy, but as an object of intelligence or strategy. So that's pretty outrageous that Bush would appoint Donald Gregg to ambassador of South Korea.
A lot of people thought he was going to be the CIA director under the Bush administration. They may have exiled him because he's been involved with so many dirty and illegal and outrageous activities over the years under supervising, with Bush supervising it, that they may have figured that he might be just too much to put before a congressional committee and have them ask a few questions.
In The Nation, Christopher Hitchens, in a very clear, blunt way, raises the question, why is George Bush wedded to that little sawed-off runt, i.e. the Tower of Sleaze, Big John? And he answers, again, not mincing any words, that John Tower went to work for the Bush campaign seconds after turning in a report on the Iran-Contra network that had even the most hardened cynics whistling a bit nervously. The Tower commissioners, Hitchens reports, came into possession of a Craig Fuller memorandum. Fuller was the head of Bush's chief of staff, that showed conclusively that Bush had lied flat out about his knowledge of the arms for hostages deal, and the Tower Commission just simply neglected to investigate this and to criticize Bush. In fact, it's also interesting to note that Brent Scowcroft, who was one of the other main figures on the Tower Commission report, was named Bush's national security advisor. So here's another person involved in the cover-up who's being rewarded with a major job by Bush. Meanwhile, Hitchens raises the question of why the American media wasn't interested in the reports that John Hall had been arrested on March the 1st in the Costa Rican town of San Carlos and charged with drug trafficking. It was Hall's enormous estate on the Costa Rican border with Nicaragua that had a big landing strip that was a major source for Contra supplies and that was reputed to be a big source of the drugs that were brought back into the United States in the Contra arms drug ring. Moreover, Hall had connections with Donald Gregg, who was one of Bush's closest national security advisors. So despite Bush and the Reagan administration's outcry over drugs, despite the arrest of Hall for drug trafficking and the connection of Hall with Bush, Gregg, and the Reagan administration, none of the media have gone in to this John Hall story and given it any publicity. In fact, Hitchens called William Bennett, Bush's new drug czar, and asked him for a comment on the Hall case, and not surprisingly, his answer was no comment. And likewise, when Hitchens called Nancy Beck at the State Department, she said she had no comment either.
So the Bush administration, not surprisingly, is trying to cover up a lot of its ties during the Reagan administration.
On television, you see these commercials, and also in the written media, magazines, etc., you see ads for overnight service by the U.S. mail. I thought, wow, that sounds great. I'm going to get me some of that. So I had to have a letter the next day up in Massachusetts, so I paid them something like $7.95, whatever it is, something like that. And at 10:55 a.m. on the 3rd of January, I put this in the mail. 6 days later, the person says, hey, I got your letter today. So I said, went to the post office and say, what is this overnight stuff? Must be a long, long night you guys had. They said, well, put in a request, get your money back. So I did. And I got back from the post office. Things said, well, we attempted to deliver it. You entered it on the 3rd. We attempted to deliver it at 8 in the morning on the 5th, 2 days later. But nobody was there at 8 in the morning. How many places are open up at 8 in the morning? And they didn't deliver it for 4 more days. But it says down the bottom of this little form, this refund is not in order. It comes within the guidelines of accepted practice by the Post Office Department.
So in other words, there's no way you can get your money back.
Yeah. It says, our goal is to give you the quality service you expect and deserve. Well, I won't expect, I certainly won't expect any from now on. About deserving, well, that's another matter.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Many people have asked us to give the names and addresses of the publications which we use for news and other source material. The Guardian is a Marxist publication. The address is 33 West 17th Street, New York, New York, 10011. The Spotlight is a right-wing populist publication, 300 Independence Avenue, Southeast, Washington, D.C., 20003. For keeping up with the CIA and other intelligence organizations, it's the Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 50272, Washington, D.C., 20004. In These Times is a Democratic Socialist publication, 1300 West Belmont, Chicago, Illinois, 60657. The Nation is a liberal magazine which has been published for many, many decades, 72 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10011. We would like to thank our crew for the production. Our director was Brian Lynch. And for one of the news sections, the camera person was Eric Eubank. Our audio man was Kevin West. We also like to thank Austin Community Television, ACTV. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Like to write to us? That's our address. Bye.